Hi, this is Barry Lissett, Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. Is American manufacturing on the rebound? After all, productivity is up, a relatively cheap dollar is boosting exports, and the wage gap between the U.S. and China is shrinking. With the good news, a new study urges caution if apparent improvements in manufacturing will be solidified. Our guests today are Dr. Wally Hopp and Dr. Roman Kapuscinski of the Tauber Institute for Global Operations at the University of Michigan. Together with Booz & Co., they've written a study entitled Manufacturing's Wake-Up Call. Those familiar with Informs may remember that Professor Hopp is a former editor of the Informs Journal Management Science. Professor Kapuscinski is a co-director of the Tauber Institute. Professor Hopp, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you, Barry.
Dr. Kapuscinski, welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Lots of pundits in the U.S. express alarm about American manufacturing and jobs going overseas. How do you and your co-authors at Booz see American manufacturing today? And Professor Hopp, would you like to start with that?
I'll be happy to. Well, I think that what we see is that it's a complex picture because the economics of manufacturing for the North American market are very close for many sectors in both the U.S. and in some of the overseas manufacturing locations. And what this means is that you can produce things overseas at a lower wage rate or produce them domestically with lower transportation costs, and the difference is not huge, but that means that there are other factors, such as, the quality of the workforce, advantage of networking and clustering, and non-economic factors that are going to be, very important in determining, where the future growth of manufacturing occurs.
I thought it would be worthwhile to take a look back in history because there is so much concern in the American press about what's happening to American manufacturing, and maybe we could go back to the year 2000. There was a decided slump at that point. What happened to manufacturing in the United States that year? Dr. Kapuscinski, would you like to take that one on?
Sure. Definitely, year 2000 is a dramatic shift in how the manufacturing started, how the number of jobs in U.S. started to look like, especially in manufacturing. The perception was that actually the manufacturing sector has been shrinking for a long period of time. However, until year 2000, this shrinkage was relatively small, and actually it was pretty much in line with what you would expect from growth of productivity. We titled our studies in manufacturing's wake-up call because last 10 years basically translate into dramatic acceleration of job losses. So this is where basically manufacturing jobs are actually disappearing. And when we started to compare these losses in U.S. compared to some of the West European countries, some of the West European countries are not experiencing similar losses. The most visible ones are Germany and Switzerland, but also some other countries are doing much better. The question is, why year 2000? I think it was the issue which was brewing over time, but at the end, multiple factors translated into U.S. starting to lose momentum at around that time.
Do you want to mention a couple of those factors?
Well, one of the factors that we emphasize very strongly is really education. Educational system in U.S. does not support strongly manufacturing sector. Other type of factors are red tape. Basically, very often manufacturers cited examples for us where it was so much easier to build a factory somewhere else in the world. Also, some of the issues were related with risk related to legislature. So basically, risks related to how uncertain will tax rate be in the U.S. versus how stable they can be in other countries.
And we'll touch on all those issues again in a few minutes. I thought we would take a look at the report which cites a statistic that U.S. factories produce 75% of the products that the nation currently consumes. It goes on to say that strong policies could push this up to 95%, but that neglect could let that figure drop to as low as 40%. Dr. Hopp, would you be able to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, see, that's back to my point about the economics not being decisive here, right? That it's not about labor cost, because in most products, labor cost is less than 10% of the total cost. You know, so when you factor in transportation costs, material costs, and so forth, that, you know, the location of where the manufacturing actually occurs, you know, is not decisive in terms of you know, what the, you know, the most economical decision will be. So what that means is that there are other factors. And so as Roman mentioned, you know, there were several things about, you know, bureaucratic red tape and levels of education. Another one is just simply the fact that American manufacturers have been underinvesting in their physical plants. And so as the physical plants get sort of, you know, less and less competitive, you know, the you know, attractiveness of you know, expanding manufacturing here gets less and less. And what it means is really that we're on a knife edge. And that's why, you know, this wake-up call is so important here, is that we've got a situation where, you know, addressing some of these non-economic problems, education, investment, taxes. I mean, taxes is a good one that we could pursue, you know, more deeply. But, you know, all of those factors are going to determine a big chunk, because the number of sectors that are solidly more economical to produce in the U.S. and the number of sectors that are solidly more economical to produce in China or some other, you know, overseas location, are, you know, relatively small, right? The big swath of the manufacturing sectors are on this bubble, which could go either way.
We often turn to Germany as a first world country that seems to have gotten right as far as manufacturing policy. What have German policymakers been doing correctly in manufacturing compared to their counterparts in the U.S.? Dr. Kapuscinski?
So, first of all, I would want to point out that Germany has been doing very well only in the last maybe 5-10 years. So when, if you look at the really long-term history, Germany struggled for a long period of time.
And if I recall correctly, their unemployment rate was about 10% maybe a decade ago or so.
At best, actually, the unemployment was typically between 10 and 14% in Germany, and actually it only started to decrease starting from year 2005. And actually, one could interpret that Germany didn't quite lose manufacturing, but was losing manufacturing, and started to go through manufacturing's wake-up call at the end of 1990s and beginning of 2000s. And a lot of debates in Germany were actually about, is manufacturing important? Should Germany do something about maintaining manufacturing sector? So there was already a good base for manufacturing in Germany. When you look at the whole educational system, it actually very strongly promotes all vocational type of schools and prepares students much better for manufacturing type of jobs. One could argue that at the cost of not preparing maybe everybody as well as U.S. at high level, the most sophisticated type of jobs, but the base is created in a wonderful way. The Germans did see that they might lose manufacturing. There was actually quite a lot of internal pride, but was to keep it, but also some kind of economics behind that. And when the recession started to hit, basically, it was very obvious from the actions that were taken by the government. At that time, probably one of the best example is really Kurzarbeit. So this is one of the steps that German government took that basically said, well, we will basically...
I'm sorry, what does Kurzarbeit mean in English?
Kurzarbeit, it means short work, but what it means that practically, giving incentives to manufacturers not to lay off as many people as they would otherwise would, and actually encouraging manufacturers not to lay off any people at all.
This was the system where they went to part-time for people they intended to lay off?
Correct. So okay. Basically, if you needed actually instead of, let's say, 15% less labor hours, could you still hold the same number of employees? And basically, maybe instead of 40 hours, they will be working 34 hours, and we would ask actually employer to to pay still 36 hours, and the government would maybe kick in an equivalent of additional 2 hours, and employee will be paid altogether for 38 hours while working 34 hours. So you could argue that in short term, that kind of promotes inefficiency, that basically you are paying for more hours than employees are working. But what it also means that basically employees are not starting to search for other jobs. The qualified workforce is kept in the same places, and when the demand starts to pick up, you are just ready to start cranking it up, and without any adjustments, you are ready to produce and quickly respond to whether internal or external demand.
And of course, on the economic, the grander economic level, those workers are still spending money, and therefore the economy is not in a downward spiral.
That's probably true. Actually, the argument in Germany was that pretty much what you would pay in unemployment benefits, they were spending on Kurzarbeit, and the bottom line was that employees felt much more happier and probably were spending more because they were not as depressed as they would otherwise be if they were unemployed and just got some kind of help only from government.
So it was a psychological factor as well.
That's correct.
There's a joke about modern robotic manufacturing that says a lot. The story goes that the goal today is to employ just 2 people in a modern factory, one to work the controls and the other to tell the first to keep his hands off the controls and let the factory run itself. In real life, what's employment like in a modern factory? Dr. Ha?
Well, there's some truth in that, I guess. You know, that obviously productivity has gone up because, many, many routine jobs have been increasingly automated. So we're not really lights out, to that extent yet. But, if you look at manufacturing employment, the low-skilled jobs have dropped much more precipitously than the overall, decrease in manufacturing employment. At the same time, the high-skilled jobs, the maintenance jobs, the programming, quality control and so forth jobs in manufacturing plants have actually been on the rise. And so what we're really seeing is not so much, a disappearance of manufacturing employment, but rather an elevation of the skill level required in modern plants. We've been, in the course of this study, talking to employers who insist on bachelor's degrees, college degrees, for people to work, in their plants, in production positions. So, it's a very different game than the sort of old-fashioned, assembly line where you kind of dropped out of high school and got a job through your uncle.
Let me remind our listeners that this is A Science of Better with Barry List of Informs. Our guests today are Wally Hopp and Roman Kapuscinski, who co-authored a study about American manufacturing. On the note you were just talking about, I noticed that while U.S. manufacturing employment has declined since 1980, and that is something that is mentioned in your report, the number of high-skilled jobs has shot up by 40%, which is tied to what you were just saying. So what exactly is going on here? Dr. Hopp, do you want to continue on that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's going on is just that as you cull out the low-skilled jobs, the things that are repetitive in nature can be automated. And so what that leaves are the things that require creativity and decision-making and analytic skills and therefore education. So, to put it simply, it's, in our little piece that accompanies this article, we basically wrote, get educated or get poor. Because what's going to happen increasingly in the world economy is that the people with skills are going to be in demand because that's what's required to run, modern enterprises. And the people without skills are going to be competing for smaller and smaller pieces of the pie. And so their wages are going to be driven down.
I would want to add that actually when we talk about education, very often there may be a misperception about what kind of education is needed for manufacturing. Very often the new manufacturing equipment requires fairly sophisticated skills, very specific understanding of materials, of how CNC machines are operating, how to basically very quickly detect if something is wrong with the process. And surprisingly few schools, small portion of schools in U.S. prepare workers like this. Very often we are talking about skills which are extremely narrow but also sophisticated and which must be geared to really very selected sectors of industry.
That's a great point.
I'm sorry, continue.
That's a great point, Roman, that specialized skill training, that vocational training, is something that the U.S. has not been particularly good at. That's the role that community colleges are intended to play. But, you know, whereas in Germany, students are tracked into vocational, educational programs relatively early and therefore receive pretty deep focused education in those kinds of specialized skills. Here in the U.S., the community colleges are sort of a mix of vocational training and sort of stepping stones to, four-year education. So if you look at the places in the U.S. that are being successful, South Carolina is one that we cite in our study. They've tried very hard to coordinate the community college education with the needs of the local industry. So industry plays a role in shaping the curriculum and making sure it's concurrent, relevant to what's going on, in the employers nearby.
Let's return to South Carolina in just a moment, but I did want to dig down a little bit into that sidebar in the article in the study. The sidebar mentions four fundamental ways that U.S. education should change to remain globally competitive in manufacturing. Could you run those down, please? Dr. Kapuscinski, maybe you'd like to take a couple, and Dr. Hopp, you might do the last two.
So basically, when you look at the education, U.S. is not preparing any more specialized students. Basically, when we talk about, and this is very strongly reflected in even unemployment structure in U.S., you have very significant number with high level of university education being unemployed versus on low level, the actual level of unemployment is much smaller. So what is really needed is some kind of matching industry needs with availability of the workforce. South Carolina is doing that exceptionally well by basically providing information through the program South Carolina Ready about what kind of plants, could be open in that area, what kind of skills may be needed. So need for matching future needs of the industry with whatever students should be really getting ready for is probably one of the most critical elements, and we see it really done extremely well in South Carolina. The other one is just simply speed of responsiveness, how quickly you can react to the needs of industry. I mean, the life of manufacturers, the life of businesses is moving very, very fast, and actually being able to both provide the workforce as well as deal with all kind of requirements, permits in a very efficient way is critical to basically for manufacturers to be optimistic about locating in given region.
Dr. Hopp, did you want to step in and add to that?
I mean, prior even to college or community college, one of the things that's happened in our high school curricula is that the industrial arts programs have largely disappeared, and so in terms of preparation for those kinds of technical training, we don't have as much as we once had. So sort of the modern version of the old industrial arts curriculum is something that we should be thinking as a nation of investing in. I guess, one other thing that, we could do better is actually make students aware of the opportunities in manufacturing, right? They hear in the news that manufacturing's gone, we're a post-industrial economy, all this kind of stuff. It's rather discouraging, when in reality, today's modern factories are really quite attractive workplaces. They have good pay and good benefits, and, the working environments are really rather nice. And yet, somehow, that doesn't seem to get out as a message to, the students, and so you don't see people actually considering that, manufacturing as a career path.
I would want to add an example, which is actually from our school, from University of Michigan. And actually, we admit a lot of bright students who basically can very quickly understand various type of concepts. However, when they are admitted to our program, very many of them have not in manufacturing facilities. When we talk to future employers, they say, well, knowing the range of facilities, understanding them is critical. So this is one of the things that we very aggressively do, is just a series of about 15 planned tours to various types of facilities where students are exposed, and even though they will probably be not working in facilities, but they will be managing them, but very early throughout the college, they would already have a picture of how this range of facilities look like, what kind of problems they are, how you can understand which facility is good, which is maybe not so good, but by just simply walking in and maybe being in that facility for 2 hours. So even this very first step of some kind of exposition, some kind of understanding what is happening in manufacturing is probably and generally missing in U.S. education.
And it seems like there's a cultural shift here. Nowadays, one thinks of going into finance to make an enormous amount of money. If one thinks back to America in the time of World War II, manufacturing was really the heart of the American economy.
True. Yeah, it is absolutely true. I was visiting German schools, talking to German students. They are proud to study manufacturing. I don't think we are getting quite the same level of emotions when I talk to U.S. students.
We're talking, you gave examples from the University of Michigan, which is, of course, a top-tier school. How can community colleges help? And you touched on that when you talked about South Carolina. How is South Carolina, for example, collaborating with industry, and what is the role of people at all levels of college education?
One of the signs of the success, of South Carolina is that the BMW plant there makes their X series and exports it to the rest of the world. Right? They're making X, series BMWs for Europe or Asia. They're making them here in the United States and sending them overseas, and those plants are staffed by, well-trained technicians who have gone to the community college programs, and they've learned skills that are very closely related to what's going on in that BMW plant.
This is the Science of Better. Our guests today are Raleigh Hopp and Roman Kapuscinski of the University of Michigan. Are young Americans interested in training to work in a factory?
I would say mostly not, but also mostly the perceptions are probably wrong. The picture of U.S. manufacturing is still as dirty, dark place. When I visit U.S. plants right now, they have changed dramatically during the last 20 years, and actually most of them got clean, pleasant places of work with pretty challenging tasks. I don't think perception of most people looking for their future careers reflects the reality how U.S. manufacturing looks like.
But even not just working in factories, the closely related functions like product design are at risk here as well, because there are deep connections between product and process innovation. And so traditionally we've co-located those things and have evolved products in close proximity with the actual manufacturing plants. But then, we've gone through this phase where we've sort of tried to divorce the design process from the production process. And that doesn't always work. And what you see is that this migration of, sort of design technology following the, process technology out the door. We've seen it in, flat panel displays, advanced battery design is a emerging technology that, the places where, lithium ion batteries have been produced have a leg up. And so, if we want to maintain, our prowess in design, I think we have to think carefully about, preserving this 40% or so of our manufacturing sector that's on the bubble that we talk about in this study.
And you mentioned some additional ways of doing that. You're quoted as saying that as far as manufacturing is concerned, American taxation has the worst of two worlds. What's the corporate tax rate, and what is the double whammy that concerns you about the way it plays out?
Yeah, well, the statutory rate in the U.S. is 35%, and so that's the rate that firms use for making their decisions. Now, they don't actually pay 35%, though, because of all the loopholes and, you know, deductions and so forth that one can take. Yet, you know, so, you know, we wind up losing both ways, that firms will locate to cheaper, you know, tax areas, and when they do locate here, they don't pay, you know, the full statutory rate anyway. And a big piece of this that we really, I don't think people have mentioned enough in the press is this notion of licensing patents into cheaper tax areas. And so what's happening is that, for instance, Apple Computer, you know, I think they pay less than 8% tax as a company, and they do that by taking their patents and moving them overseas to, you know, Ireland or places like this where, you know, the tax rate is low, and they, you know, they don't repatriate the income to the U.S. because then they would owe, you know, tax on that. So it's really a bad system that we have right now that's basically driving not only production overseas, but also, you know, the actual patent licenses as well.
And there's, of course, a lot of concern about these jobs going overseas and manufacturing going to China, Southeast Asia. You have a proposal to help it, and it relates to our neighbor to the south. What do you recommend about the U.S. working with Mexico on manufacturing?
So we have seen that actually geographical distances make a gigantic difference. In Europe, German manufacturers also recognized that there were a lot of cheaper tasks, simpler tasks, that basically may not be able economically be done in Germany. They outsource them. They outsource some of the cheaper tasks to maybe Czech Republic, Slovak Republic, to Poland. However, the engineers still stay in Germany, and basically this is a little bit related to the fact that engineer can take pretty much a day trip to one of those countries, and when needed to still supervise these jobs to see how the plant is working. This is much more difficult when you outsource from U.S. to China. Basically, that's what Wally was referring to, that there tends to be, the engineering jobs tend to follow the manufacturing jobs, but that happens when basically location is far away. When the location is relatively close, the pull is much weaker, and that's where we basically argue that performing some of the cheaper jobs in Mexico may actually be a win-win situation for both countries. Basically, some of the design jobs may still stay in the U.S. Some of the even manufacturing jobs will stay in the U.S. Coordination between U.S. and Mexico, bringing products back and forth, may be easier. And even further, the dollars earned in Mexico will probably be more likely spent in the U.S. compared to dollars earned in China.
Another of your recommendations is about industry clusters. What are they and how do they help? Dr. Hopp?
Well, an industry cluster is, you know, a set of companies that are sort of mutually supportive. And so, for instance, the Silicon Valley is an example of a very powerful cluster. As, you know, you have your, you know, solid state, you know, technology there, you know, and, you know, they share employees move between these firms. The firms act as suppliers or consultants, you know, to each other. And so there's a very powerful demonstrable advantage to locating in a cluster for an industry. I mean, Detroit was once upon a time an incredibly powerful cluster in the automotive industry, you know, Pittsburgh in steel. So we see these things, and most of the clusters that we speak of are organic. They sort of grew naturally and became very influential. And now that people recognize their influence, the question is it possible to cultivate clusters with an industrial policy? So, for instance, Taiwan and the semiconductor industry is a place where, you know, the country recognized that they had, you know, the potential for a burgeoning cluster and invested in that to support and nurture it.
Of course, if everybody's dependent on a single country, as we saw with Thailand, if you have a natural event and your suppliers are shut down, everybody's in trouble along the supply chain.
That's a great problem. That's you know, one of the challenges of the you know, global economy is that we're so tightly linked together that, you know, when we have these clusters or you know, geographically proximal facilities, they can be at risk. And so that's a problem that you know, manufacturers need to think about when they're investing, you know, in these you know, facilities, is how much risk, you know, do you have? How much should you, you know, dual source, say? That nevertheless, there still is, you know, benefit of clusters, and you'll see those. And it doesn't mean that there has to be only one for a particular industry in the world, but you know, there's certainly power in them.
We only have time for a couple more questions, and since both of you are professors of management science, is there a connection between this report and your specialty, Professor Hopp?
Well, absolutely, absolutely. You know, one of the connections here is, you know, making a considered balancing of these costs. You know, what we've seen is this sort of pendulum swing between outsourcing and then, you know, sort of insourcing back into the U.S. that have not been made on sort of fully landed cost calculations. So operations research people are, you know, particularly well skilled to make the kinds of economic calculations that are needed here to make sensible decisions about locating manufacturing. And then when we do, you know, judging the risk involved in a global supply chain is, again, the kind of calculation that an operations researcher or management scientist, you know, is particularly well suited to make.
Final question. Looking to the future of American industry in this election year, are you optimistic or pessimistic? Perhaps Professor Kapuscinski, you'd like the last word.
Well, I'm really happy that the issue of manufacturing and manufacturing jobs has actually come up to attention of policymakers now and potential presidential candidates, because this is the issue which was probably neglected and should not be neglected in the last 10 years. Bringing it up to the top of the discussion will likely translate into much better, first of all, in much more attention to the right decision, and hopefully in the right investment that U.S. was missing, and better policies that Congress will likely to pass.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Dr. Wally Hopp and Dr. Roman Kapuscinski of the Tauber Institute for Global Operations at the University of Michigan. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.